Hello and welcome back to the NovPod, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. My name's Owen Dorr, I'm one of the co-hosts, and we are delighted to bring you this podcast in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Obstetric Anaesthetists Association. This is one of our last clinical episodes, as the rest will focus on communication within obstetric anaesthetics. This is the postpartum visit, your follow-up. And I'd hazard a guess that this has a variation in how it's taught across the country. So we really wanted to provide this episode to give you a basis as to why, even on a busy day, it's important to follow up people following neuraxial interventions of spinals and epidurals. And we'll go through headache, we'll go through dealing with neurological deficit and the structural approach to both. And then we'll touch upon how to start the debrief when people have got events they want to flag up to you. We have, as always, got some really good links in bio, including a BGA review article on postpartum headache that's been co-authored by one of my previous consultants, a Dr. Robin Russell, who was also the editor of the IJOA. I'd really recommend having a look over towards that. As ever, if you like the podcast, please do share with colleagues and friends, and we hope you enjoy. Welcome back to the NovPod, episode 10. This is the last of our clinical aspect of the series. This is the postpartum visit.
Woohoo!
Well, my name's Owen Dorr. I'm an SA reg in Thames Valley, and with me today is the great...
I thought you were going to say the great Grimo or something awful like that.
No.
My name's Rosie. I am an anaesthetic registrar in South East London.
How fantastic. And we're recording today at the college. I would like to describe it as a grey day out, but hopefully it won't be a grey podcast coming out. So we've got a topic that will be divisive among some of the trainees, because the first thing is, what is the point? Why am I seeing all these people? I don't normally see the people post-op. And hopefully today our learning outcomes are to convince you, yes, do please see them. And what is the point, Rosie? Why do we go, apart from to disturb people's sleep and bonding experiences with an awkward anaesthetist coming in and saying, did you like your anaesthetic? Oh, what was an anaesthetic?
I actually quite like the postpartum visit part of this, because firstly, you get to leave labour ward, which is sometimes exciting.
I mean, we have been convincing people that being on labour ward's great, so we can't divvy from the party line.
Okay, here we go. I'll rephrase it. Firstly, you get a change of scenery.
Oh, that sounds way more positive than leaving labour ward. It's a change of scenery. That's way more buzzing. Lovely.
Generally, it's a relatively happy place. And also, there's often a coffee shop near the postnatal ward.
Yeah.
Which is also exciting. And you get to meet cute babies, and you also often get to see women who you have managed, potentially, if it's people you've given an anaesthetic to. And that can be really nice. That can be really fulfilling. Like, you see them at the end of their journey and you're like, oh, yay, I made a nice difference there.
Sort of now just imagining you going round every woman that you've provided an epidural live with a flat white in the hands, waiting for their applause now. That hasn't really given me any of the information that we're asking for. Because you've actually written in capitals, what is the point? Which makes me think you're shouting it. For the lovely second time, with your flat white in hands, you're interrupting these wonderful bonding experiences. Why are you doing that?
Most of what we do in anaesthesia and obstetric anaesthesia is really safe and really effective. But there are some important aspects where things can go wrong, and there is morbidity and mortality associated with what we do directly and our interventions. And we need to make sure that we are picking up on that potential complication with that woman that could potentially be life-changing for her. And some people can find labour and delivery a very stressful experience, and it's really important, I think, to go back after the fact and just check that everything's okay and they understand why things were done the way that they were done, why decisions were made. And there also might be some pretty important stuff to pass on to a future anaesthetist if they do decide to have another child. So other than the proximity to the coffee shop, there are some actual important reasons.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for actually providing us with some clinical context and for giving me a wonderful description, essentially, of how you use the postnatal visit to go and buy yourself coffee. That's delightful. And
it's all part of well-being.
It's all part of hashtag well-being, isn't it? You put your oxygen mask on first before you put on
other people's oxygen masks, which I don't believe is the DAS guidelines either, is it? Moving on to what is the point? Well, I guess there are some serious complications that result from our involvement with the maternal population. The risks are rare. However, when you've got someone whose primary concern is likely no longer themselves, but their babies, they may be very dismissive of things such as headache or not being able to move their leg. So thinking about headaches, neurological deficit, post-procedures such as spinal or epidural, thinking about debriefing people, because these can be, and we'll get on to some of the stats, which are quite surprising, these are traumatic events for people potentially. And then the advocacy of both pain relief, anti-sickness, and making sure that people have the correct VT and the correct breastfeeding advice is really important. And then we'll probably start off by talking about how you can set that up before the end of the cesarean section as well, Rosie. Does that all make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like the learning outcomes of this to be that you don't feel panicked when you approach a headache, that you have a systematic way of dealing with it, and you feel a bit more confident about escalating to seniors, because some of these symptoms can be time critical with how you deal with them and what you do about them.
Yeah, especially when you're thinking about trying to get scans and stuff like that, those things are only going to get done and reported sometimes, you know, in hours rather than out of hours. So it can be a bit tricky to organise.
Have you ever had a postural punch headache that you've caused?
Yes.
Yeah, so have I.
It was very obvious when I did the epidural and the plunger came back at me. So I immediately knew what had happened, and she did develop a severe headache and she had an epidural blood patch, and it worked very well for her.
I've had a pretty similar, and I think anyone who says they haven't caused a dural tap either has done less than 100 epidurals or may not recognise when they've done one.
I hadn't got to 100 when I did it, so I was like, no.
I think as you get more experience, your hands tremble a bit less with it. But I think that moves us quite nicely on to headache, really, because this isn't a benign topic. We've got a broad range of differentials that you have to be thinking about when you're approaching the ladies. And even postural puncture headache isn't insignificant. The Embrace report had two deaths, I believe, from 2009 to 2012 that were attributed to postural puncture headache, one due to a central venous thrombosis, and the other due to a subdural hematoma.
It's not necessarily just a headache from the epidural. There are some serious complications if it's not picked up and acted on.
Okay, so Rosie, how do you go and approach it?
So I think I quite commonly hear about headaches postnatally. Mm-hmm. And I guess if you are somebody who's prone to headaches, there are a lot of things about the process of having a baby and labour and delivery that would predispose you to having a headache, being sleep deprived, not having very much to drink, being stressed, etc. What I find helpful is having just like a basic structure of history, examination, and then thinking about red flags to try and rule in or out possible differentials, and then thinking about a robust way of handing that over and speaking to the woman about what I think it may or may not be, and speaking to a consultant on labour ward about it as well, just because you want to make sure you're not missing anything.
When you're approaching headache, you've got a broad diagnosis that it could be. You've got primary headaches, which are headache disorders such as migraine tension. Then you've got secondary headaches, which can have a broad surgical sieve approach to it.
Yeah, it's a massive differential, right?
It is, and it can be quite overwhelming, really. You've got vascular, infection, drugs, homeostasis issues such as hypertension. You've got drugs. You've then got non-vascular issues that includes postural puncture headache. So,
yeah, and if you think about like the obstetric population, okay, if you've had a spinal or an epidural, it could be a PDPH. But it could also be intracranial bleeding because they've got PIH or PET, could be a symptom of PET, could be a venous sinus thrombosis because they're hypercoagulable. So there are other things other than a PDPH that it might be that are related just to their obstetric presentation.
Exactly. And you need to keep a broad differential and a positive inquiry approach. Is that the 2024 way of saying that keeping your thoughts open?
I like that. We could just say open-minded.
Open-minded. Okay, fine. We'll go back to the 90s with that. So of the vascular things, you can still have subarach hemorrhages. Subdural hemorrhages can occur, as we mentioned with that EMBRACE report.
Yeah.
As a result, I think the pathophysiology is that they think that due to the Monroe-Kelly doctrine, you lower the pressure within the fixed box of the CSF massively drops down, which leads to negative pressure causing tearing of some of the subdural veins. The other things that it could be is intracranial bleed, which can occur when you, as you've mentioned, have preeclampsia. And then there's cerebral vein thromboses, where your risk factors when you've got someone who's procoagulopathic are increased in your postpartum women.
Mm. I've actually seen somebody have that antenatally.
Any learning points from that?
Just have a really high index of suspicion of something bad going on if somebody presents with a headache when they're pregnant or immediately postpartum. And what you want to be doing is making sure that there's absolutely nothing exciting going on.
Yeah, because the diagnosis for that is MR, isn't it?
Yeah, she had to have an MRV, I think.
Which is not available in some hospitals out of hours. That's why quick reviews are needed and maybe delegations. If you've got back-to-back Cat 2s, you've got to think about who you're sending out.
Yeah. Oh, that brings me on to quite a nice point about like general points to do with follow-ups. They often get missed because it will frequently come down to the labour ward team on call to do them. So you may find that you can't do the follow-ups on a certain day because you're just too stretched. And it's always worth kind of highlighting to your seniors if you have been in a position where that's happened. Because as we've said, there are important complications that can be missed if people don't get followed up. And so if that's something that's happening regularly in your unit, it might just be worth flagging it up and saying, look, I'm not managing, or we as a team of obs on call, we're not managing to do the follow-ups. But there are obviously better and worse times to go and do it. If you go in the afternoon, which is often when you have a bit more time, you might find that lots of the parents are on NICU or having a rest or something. So it can be tricky to find the optimal time to do it, but it is really important to try.
Yeah, that moves on to what the structured approach might be. So if I've been called to see someone for their headache, I would try to take a bit more of a history to ascertain how quickly I need to see them, but try to review them relatively quickly or delegate someone else to do it. Or I say delegate. Can you use the word delegate with your consultant?
Politely request.
Politely request. So I might politely request my consultant to go and see them. I would want to look at the anaesthetic chart, know if they've had a documented dural puncture, although some may not be recognised or indeed documented. You've then got the obs that you're looking at. We've already mentioned that homeostasis and hypertension can present as headache, so looking to make sure they've not got a hypertensive disorder. You may want to review their notes to see if there's any significant past medical history. And not uncommon would be that someone may have something such as migraine. Mm. Very rare might be they have something neurosurgical to think about. You've then got the approach by asking the MDT staff, midwife looking after them, directly what their concerns are when you're on the ward. And then locating the women doing a full history, including things that make it worse, better, what time of day it comes on, and then doing an examination, including cranial nerves, gait, and upper and lower limb assessments. We mentioned that the rare vascular causes would be subarach, subdural, so it's important to have a documented, almost rule out that you've looked, there was no weakness at that time, so that if someone is reviewing them, as we'll get on, one of the recommendations, if you have postural puncture, for example, is someone recommends them daily, they can say, oh, wait, that limb was 5 out of 5 yesterday, now it's 4 out of 5. Quick, urgent MR, for example.
Yeah, you need to be able to detect changing neurology.
Rosie, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think it's a classic headache history, isn't it? We can all do a Socrates for a headache. I think the important things for, particularly for a postural puncture headache, are asking about some of the things that are classically associated with it. So there's an official definition from the International Headache Society.
This is postural puncture, right?
For postural puncture headache. But I would be trying to just ascertain where the headache is. What does it feel like? Is there any associated neck stiffness, back pain? Are there any hearing or visual symptoms? Tinnitus, classically, you can get. Then the postural element can be a little bit controversial now. So classically, we used to always say that there was commonly a postural element associated with the headache, i.e. it's better when they're lying down, it's worse when they're sitting or standing. That has actually been taken out of the definition now, but you may still see it. The important point, I think, to note with this is that there are quite a lot of headaches which are postural puncture headaches which are actually atypical. They don't fit the classic definition of X, Y, and Z. So if you get one of those atypical headaches, just remain open to the possibility that this might still be a PDPH, because they don't always fit an exact pattern of symptoms.
As you mentioned there, the definition from the International Headache Society.
Mm-hmm.
God, what a fun committee that must be.
The ICD something definition of it.
Yeah, is that they must have like the most raucous events, mustn't they? Is that it is something where you have a headache that appears within 5 days of a lumbar puncture due to CSF leakage characterized by symptoms such as neck stiffness, and that it will resolve within 2 weeks or after an epidural blood patch.
There are a lot of studies that kind of show that they can present outside of that time frame. They can not necessarily always resolve within that time frame. There can be different symptoms associated with them. So to avoid confusion, that's the official definition, but there are some extra bits that you can read about, which we will link the article into the episode description. So if you've got a spare bit of time, give it a read.
Lovely. He also mentioned some other things, not just that you tell the ladies to drink less than 900 milligrams of caffeine, which sounds like a delicious day, but they also make some key recommendations.
There are some specific things about the pregnant population which make them more prone to having PDPH. Things like being a bit younger, being female sex. There's also evidence that in terms of like the procedural factors, i.e. how the neuraxial has actually been done, obviously now we use non-cutting needles, which are better in terms of the instance of PDPH,
mm-hmm.
but smaller needles, fewer attempts, and there's a small point about experienced operators, but we will all become experienced operators the more that we do. Interestingly, which I didn't know, being in the lateral position is protective, which makes sense if you think about it.
The lateral position when you do the epidural.
Yeah, which I'm not as good at. It's something that I have been told by consultants is a really good skill to get good at, because it's also obviously a bit more comfortable for the women to lie on their side.
Yeah, it depends on the bed, right, as to how easy it is to do. I often do my spinals lateral.
If you ask me about the imaging, I'll pick you up on that. So lots of the times brain imaging will be normal if you've got PDPH,
mm-hmm.
and it's not necessarily needed. It's a clinical diagnosis. But you might want to do imaging to rule out any of the other more sinister causes that we've talked about that would show signs on brain imaging. Sometimes the imaging in a PDPH will show the classical changes that you see with intracranial hypotension, i.e. low pressure CSF, which is kind of like sagging of the brainstem. It's called, the acronym is SEEPS, which is in the paper. But sometimes if you've got a red flag, if you've got severe headache, you've got reduced conscious level, if you've got a focal neurological deficit, or the woman's had seizures, or it's an atypical history like we've talked about, those patients, you would probably be thinking, let's get some brain imaging, and then we can see, just check there's not anything else going on. That's what they recommend.
And again, timely, you assess the patient, you obs, history, and examination, speak to a senior, and then decide what the next action plan is. You don't have to have all the answers when you're assessing the lady in front of you. You can say that you're going to go back and get some more information. There's a nice little box, and as someone who likes to tick boxes for my own CV, coming up to ARCP season, I've appreciated this one, that goes through some of the basic things about postural puncture headaches. So firstly is that these ladies need to be daily reviewed, and that can be in person or could be via telephone consult. You need to think about the benefit of bed rest for improving symptoms versus the risk that they have for thromboembolic events. So if you've got someone who's not on VTE but has a much reduced mobility due to the fact that every time they try and sit up they're vomiting, or they can't even breastfeed their child, then maybe they should be on prophylactic linoleic heparin. They also recommend adequate fluids, so making sure they're drinking plenty, so make sure they've got good anti-sickness with that they consider oral analgesics, and paracetamol weak opiates and I believe non-steroidals are advocated for. Strong opiates are not advocated for longer than 72 hours and aren't really seen to make much of a difference. And then my favourite intervention of all time, less than 900 milligrams of caffeine, is got very poor or weak evidence. And then other
weird... You have to be careful if you're breastfeeding, it's less. 200 to 300 milligrams if you're breastfeeding.
Yeah, otherwise you're going to get a very jittery and crying baby, aren't you?
How much caffeine is in this cup of tea that I've got next to me?
50 milligrams.
That's why I have about 8 a day then.
I think flat white usually has between 180 and 250 milligrams, depending on where you go. And an instant cup of coffee can have up to 80 milligrams. Yeah. The other thing is that to note is that there are some weird and wonderful therapies such as theophyllins and gabapentins that I've heard of people and the whispers of the wind describe. And actually, there's no evidence for them in that article that I've read. And I've used Robin Russell's opinion to not question it, not to the evidence myself, but I've just used it as a blanket approach to what I'd recommend.
It makes an interesting point, though, doesn't it? Because there might be no evidence for something, but if somebody finds it helpful and there's no harm, then it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't use it. And I'm not talking about things like gabapentin. I'm talking about there are some other things mentioned in that article, like acupuncture and abdominal binders. If somebody finds it helpful and wants to use it, then I don't think you need to take it away. But we do need to be mindful that we're having honest conversations with patients about the best evidence we have to say what does and doesn't work.
But there is one intervention that we can do that makes quite a big benefit. What is it?
Epidural blood patch.
Yeah, just when you've had a complication from an epidural causing a postural puncture headache.
Do another one.
The last thing you're going to want to hear is an anaesthetist going, oh, but we could try it again, right? So why do we tell people to have epidural blood patches or advocate for them having them?
So technically an epidural blood patch is the gold standard in the interventional treatment of PDPH. Essentially, or the way I would explain it to patients is you are trying to use something to seal the hole that's in the dura, which has been made by the needle poking in there. And that will stop the fluid from leaking out and help the symptoms. And what we're using to do that is something that the body won't reject, or, you know, it's not artificial. So the best thing to do to form a clot is something in your body that clots normally, which is blood. So we take your blood in a very sterile manner and we inject it into your bag, which actually, if you think about it, sounds like a wild idea.
That is one of the proposed mechanisms. I think the other one is to do with the pressure effect in the epidural space that reduces the amount of CSF leaking.
But yeah, so you're increasing the pressure in the CSF by injecting a volume of stuff.
Rosie, very leading question. Do you know who the first person to describe a postural puncture headache was?
No.
It was the German Beer, as Beersblock, who I believe took his assistant and himself, and they used a very large needle to inject cocaine into each other's backs to see what the effect was, and then were drew much joy out of hitting each other with hammers, and then described the next day of waking up as if they'd had a really bad whiskey headache. And that's just at the turn of the 20th century.
That is very strange.
I would wonder what the ethical approval process would be nowadays to get that done.
Yeah, I think we probably wouldn't be successful.
All this red tape is stopping us from injecting each other with all the local anaesthetics that we can find. Very upsetting. Anyway, lost to science. So Rosie, sorry, that was a deviation away from the wonderful world of epidural blood patches into someone who might have needed one self-inflicted. One, when do we do epidural blood patches? So you described it as an aseptic technique where two people, the most experienced person to do an epidural, injects blood into, I think it's the space or below the space because that's quite a cephalad spread. But when do we do these?
The recommendation is that we would offer an epidural blood patch to someone with suspected PDPH if the conservative measures that we've talked about already, so your symptomatic bed rest, fluids, plus minus caffeine, multimodal analgesia, have failed and it's significantly interfering with that person's activities of daily living. So you can imagine trying to look after a newborn baby is very stressful, and that interference with that and the bonding and everything is potentially quite unpleasant. So that is when I would offer an epidural blood patch. In terms of timing, there's some interesting evidence that shows that if a blood patch is done earlier than 48 hours after the dural puncture, there's a higher chance that it needs to be repeated. But again, if you read the literature around this, it's a little bit conflicting, because if somebody presents that early with such severe symptoms, it's likely that they've got a larger hole in their dura, and therefore you have a higher chance of needing to repeat your epidural blood patch. And if you leave it longer, then you have potentially had some healing of that hole already, just naturally. So then you do an epidural blood patch and you go, oh, that worked really well, that we've got better outcomes there. So it's a little bit conflicting. But if you do one earlier than 48 hours, you should be consenting the woman for a need for a repeat procedure.
I mean, from that, it would make sense that there is an element of confounder in there, right? But why read when you can listen to a podcast?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the recommendations are 15 to 20 mils of blood, exactly correctly as you said, at the level, if you know it, or one level below, because you get quite a bit of cephalad spread. And if you're unsuccessful the first time, or if it's tricky, you can use things like ultrasound or fluoroscopy to help with that, if that's available in your institution. They're not without risk, and we need to be having informed conversations with patients. Your hospital might have an information leaflet about this, and there's definitely one on the OAA, or they're easily available on Google. And we need to be saying to women, okay, the success rate for them is variable. So I think the studies quote anything from 30 to 90%. So that's a massive range.
I don't do much research, but it seems to be quite a broad range.
It's a big range.
Yeah.
They might need to have a repeat procedure. There is potential risk for backache, neurological complications, infection, things like that. If you do one and it doesn't work at all, it might be worth reconsidering the diagnosis before you go into repeating one. I think one of the things that I found when I was first doing OBS was, because it's a consultant-led procedure, I would often have the conversation and then it would be more of a handover and let the consultant know who's on the labour ward the next morning, for example, and then somebody would go and review them again and they'd be deciding whether or not they wanted to go for it or not.
Lovely. And whilst we're mentioning that, that's not to confuse with, if you've gone firstly to see someone and you think there are red flags present, you would escalate that very quickly, not wait till the next morning.
Yeah.
At Mediplus, we've been working alongside anaesthetists for over 20 years, developing innovative devices you use every day when high flow is key. Our collaboration has delivered the successful peripheral IV Coventry connector. It's a trusted favourite in delivery suites worldwide. Don't take our word for it. Talk to your colleagues and discover the Mediplus difference. Visit us at www.mediplusuk.com to learn more.
Rosie, hopefully that makes headache less of a headache. The other thing we mentioned was that part of the complication is neurological dysfunction post interventions such as spinal epidural, and there's actually a handy guideline from the association from 2020. What are the key points that our listeners should pick out from that?
My most important one from this is that the woman should be able to straight leg raise 4 hours after the last dose of epidural or spinal local anaesthetic. And if they can't, then they should tell somebody. That person should ideally contact the anaesthetist to perform a full assessment.
And again, if you're stuck in theatre for another 2-3 hours, that's when you try to mobilise the team around you for someone's going to see that person, right?
Yeah, and there are some nice quality improvement projects that have been ongoing with things like wristbands.
Yeah.
A really simple way to do it is you can just say to the woman, set a reminder on your phone for this time. If you feel like you can't lift your legs up at that point, not together, obviously, that would be a feat after delivering a baby. But if you can't lift each leg up with your legs straight in turn, let the midwife know, ask and say that I've asked to be called and notified, because you need to be going to see them. It doesn't necessarily mean that something's wrong. If you see them and you think that everything is looking okay, but you've potentially got a slightly long-lasting block, fine. You can review them again a bit later and make sure that if you've got a nicely resolving block, then that's okay. It might just be a bit slow, but you do need to monitor and make sure that you're not worried about a potentially serious problem, which what we're looking for is essentially an epidural hematoma. That's what we're worried about.
Yeah.
That's what we want to make sure it's not.
Well, the risk is like about one in 100,000 per cases. So this is something that someone in the UK will be seeing, and it is time critical for assessment, imaging and intervention.
There's a really nice flow chart in that guideline, which is a summary of postpartum neurological deficit. And it just tells you kind of how to assess things, how to divide them and what to do about them. You may find, if you are worried about an epidural hematoma, that you need to get some pretty urgent spinal imaging, which is going to involve discussing with a radiologist and a radiographer and making sure that that scan gets reported and potentially speaking to neurosurgeons. And if you're not in a neurosurgical centre, that can potentially be quite challenging, and you need to make sure it's done quickly, because the longer you leave it, the longer the risk of permanent paralysis.
Yeah, and they are always lovely people to ring up, the neurosurgeons. Shout out to them. One of our other roles, we've done headache, we've done neurological dysfunction, is re-discussing the events and maybe highlighting people who may have suffered from birth trauma. We can visit women post-op and explain some of the events that happen, and that is really important to some people where things have been go, 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 and they haven't had the chance for things to be explained. Out of interest, Rosie, according to the Birth Trauma Association, what are the percentages when it comes to people who have PTSD post-birth?
I'd have no idea about a percentage, but I would say I would think it's probably more common than you might at first think.
I haven't got the definition that they use, but yeah, they quote between 4-5% of mothers giving birth have a form of PTSD.
Yeah, so more, 1 in 20, isn't it?
That's, yeah, that's what 5% means. Thank you.
Just going to pause while I punch her in.
Thank you very much. I think this is a very careful topic, and it's something where you can have a significant impact on people's journey. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There'll often be things where people have a lot of adrenaline, a lot of stress, are very tired, and they won't really understand maybe why they ended up having a cesarean section or why you had to do the spinal a couple of times. And you can have a really good intervention by either discussing it or recognising they need further support and flagging that to a senior or to the obstetric team. And there are some risk factors that associated with the development of PTSD that are listed by the Birth Trauma Association. And they're pretty much a lot of the cases that we get involved in.
Are they so, like Cat 1 sections and things like that?
Yep, so C-section, instrumental deliveries of high risk. Anything else?
Prolonged labour, bleeding, so, emergencies.
Yeah, so PPH is labelled as a risk, and pain that lasts for several hours. These are things that we really get involved in, separations of mother from baby without things being adequately explained. Yeah. And that's where you can have a huge impact pre, intra and post-op. And part of the visit is discussing people with the events, seeing how they're feeling, because you're not only going to affect them directly at the time, you could be affecting their ability to engage with health services later, or even their wants or desire to have another child. And I think being able to recognise and flag up and streamline people into the correct follow-up is quite a powerful tool to have.
Yeah, I think this brings us back to another general follow-up point, which I didn't always appreciate when I was first starting obstetrics. But when you've got your list of follow-ups, however you generate that in your hospital, whether it's a book, whether it's a computer system, whatever it is, just have a scan through it. Have a look at if there's a bit about neonatal outcome or a bit about what happened. Have a look through the notes before you go in and have that conversation. There is nothing worse than walking into a postnatal room all jolly and going, "How was everything?" And them saying to you, are you joking? You know, you just don't want to be in that situation. So if there have been really difficult anaesthetic complications, if the baby's not had a good outcome, it's really important to go into that room sensitively and knowing what you, as much as you can know about the situation. Obviously, the majority of your follow-ups are going to be very bog standard, had an epidural or a spinal, everything was fine. But if it's not fine, then as you've said, you've got an opportunity to actually have a meaningful conversation with that person. And if it wasn't fine and you go in and have a bad conversation, that can make it a lot worse.
Yeah, and I think as the patient advocate, Susanna Stanford, in one of our later episodes, not being believed is one of the biggest causes of patient trauma.
Yeah.
Really.
And also, I don't mean to be cynical, but there is a lot of obstetric litigation surrounding bad outcomes and pain and things like that. And actually, if you have a really, really positive conversation with somebody and you can, you know, be patient, listen to them, explain to them why the anaesthetic things happened the way they did, I would be cautious, very cautious about delving into any obstetric reasoning, because you're not an obstetrician.
No, that's not your ballpark.
That's not for you to comment on. But if you can explain why the anaesthetic things happened the way that they did, then you can often really, really make a difference to somebody's journey. I would also potentially think about taking somebody with you for those conversations if they're going to be potentially challenging, and definitely highlighting to whoever the consultant on call is, especially if this is somebody who might need another conversation a bit further on down the line. There's an anaesthetic follow-up clinic that they should be able to access where they can have a more detailed conversation, perhaps when events are not so fresh. So being able to signpost to those services as well is really important.
We're not experts in this. We are just talking about our previous experiences in it and the importance of going, having open conversations and being ready to respond. And so that brings us on to our next point, which is the advocacy for some of the ERAS protocol stuff. So this is enhanced recovery, where we're talking about analgesia, making sure they've got the correct VTE. And also, what's one of the common questions you get asked?
Things that I never used to know the answer to was about breastfeeding.
This is something that's not taught at medical school well, it's not taught in foundation, and it's, in my opinion, not taught very well on the anaesthetic curriculum currently. There was a presentation by a Major Fryer who did a survey of trainees, and it showed that over 50% thought after a GA you had to get rid of your breast milk and stop breastfeeding, which just isn't true. And it's a opportunity to educate and maybe improve mother-baby bonding or reduce some of the anxiety that might be caused by people receiving drugs and not knowing whether or not they can breastfeed with it. Great. So if a woman wants to breastfeed, tiny amounts realistically of anaesthetic drugs pass on into the baby. It depends on the bioavailability of the drug, to do with its size, structure, whether or not it's lipid soluble. However, this has been streamlined by an association guideline talking about breastfeeding. Just to summarise how breast milk is produced, it's secreted due to the actions of prolactin and oxytocin. The importance of knowing about this is manufacturers do not take any liability when it comes to breastfeeding. And if you look at the leaflets, they all say potentially avoid or do not avoid.
Yeah. Or if you Google anything, it's like, don't take that, don't take that.
Exactly. And so that's why the association came up with this guideline, because actually things are secreted in small amounts, but they're seen to be negligible. Okay, so we're going to go over the common drugs that get used. So
I'm just hoping now that you say that everything that I've been prescribing for however many years is actually safe.
Well, say for your anaesthetic, the IV induction agents and muscle relaxants and gases are seen to have significantly small amounts that you are seen to be safe to breastfeed afterwards. Okay, you paracetamol's fine. Non-steroidals are seen to be such small amounts go over that there seem to be low toxicity, so they're fine to use. The one drug that's not, that is seen as a oral low on the WHO analgesic ladder of aspirin, is not to be used.
I mean, who even gives that to anyone anyway?
Well, they may be on it for other reasons, but
yeah, it's true. We don't prescribe it that frequently.
We don't prescribe it that frequently.
I don't think I've ever prescribed anyone aspirin in anaesthetics.
Well, if you go back to people having headaches and migraine, people commonly take aspirin for migraines, don't they? However, the Australian, so good on you, mate, Ray, a Australian pathologist, describes something called Ray syndrome, which
I didn't know he was Australian.
I googled him. Describes something called Ray syndrome, which is infant morbidity and mortality associated with taking aspirin and being breastfed as well, which causes fatty liver and encephalopathy.
Okay, so paracetamol and non-steroidals, fine. Aspirin, nil.
Aspirin. Yeah.
Ooh.
Oh, no, right, we've got some sound effects here. Opioids are thought to go across in very small amounts, so morphine and fentanyl are seen to be acceptable, although they, can affect alertness. Pethidine has an increased effect on neonates, so it is recommended to be avoided in the association guideline. Codeine, due to the atypical metabolism, has been recorded to had neonatal respiratory depression and deaths, and so is avoided in nearly all the hospitals I've worked in.
Yeah.
And in the association guideline, they say to avoid it. However, in the e-learning for health module, they say low doses of codeine can be used. However, I think as a blanket statement for a novice, unless you have a hospital policy, codeine should be a as per the association guidelines.
Yeah, we've normally prescribed dihydrocodeine.
Dihydrocodeine, fine. Yeah. And then there are some other drugs which they say to avoid. So these are the... So cocaine, aspirin, codeine, pethidine, diazepam, and huge doses of caffeine you are told to avoid whilst breastfeeding.
Yeah.
And then they mentioned caution in these association guidelines of tramadol and oxycodone over 40 milligrams per day.
Okay. We're probably all right within our ERAS guidelines with most of that, aren't we?
What's the only thing that you're probably going to prescribe is, in reality, is codeine, and so substitute it out for dihydrocodeine. Yeah. The rest are safe. You can tell them to breastfeed.
Yeah.
Now, you can say that they go over in very small amounts. There can be some increased neonatal somnolence, but there is advice from the Association of Anaesthetists that still find to breastfeed with the above, and do have a look at it. Does that clarify things up?
Yeah, I think so.
Fantastic. All right, then. And lastly, we have the beginning of the story, which is the postnatal visit starts at when you are at the head end of the bed and they're wrapping up the surgery. So what can we do to improve people's knowledge of their journey postnatally when we are with them?
So normally, as I'm wheeling the woman into recovery, I would say something along the lines of, you know, I'm bringing you into recovery now. You'll have one-on-one midwife here now. If you need anything else, just ask for it. The feeling in your legs should come back to you in the next few hours. What I want you to do is set a reminder on your phone for this time and just make sure that you can lift up your legs at this point. Might be a little bit difficult, but you should be able to do it. If you can't, let the midwife know. They'll call me. And then I would explain the analgesia that I've prescribed and what she can ask for if she wants anything extra. I'd explain that I've prescribed extra anti-sickness and some anti-itching medication. And then I would say, I've also prescribed for you this blood thinning injection that you're going to get tomorrow.
Yeah, if
whatever,
indicated.
If indicated. And then the last thing I would say, one of our anaesthetic team will try and come and see you tomorrow to check that you're doing okay. But if you have any concerns about the anaesthetic, please let the midwives know and they can always phone one of us.
Nice. I also ask the partner to be listening at the same time as well, because different people pick up different information.
Yeah.
Before we even leave theatre, I do try and get a photo, first family photo, with no staff members involved or patient identifiable information.
With you in it.
Yeah. I'm normally a photo taker rather than a photee. Right, so the postpartum visit is not just a tick box exercise. It's for the identification of rare and serious complications, along with the advocacy for painkillers, breastfeeding guidelines, and also making sure that they are receiving what you've prescribed post-op.
Yeah.
And it can be used as a really important tool for both identification and referral of people who may have experienced events that could lead them to having birth trauma and PTSD.
Yeah.
So you are a patient advocate. Go, be proud. Don't feel you're interrupting everyone, although you probably are, and say why you're there. And also, it can be quite a nice time to get feedback for people. So if they've particularly had a good experience, or maybe if they would like to pass on some words to people, you can jot that into an email, because that could really brighten up someone's day.
Yeah.
I had a really annoying person I worked with at Frimley who always received good feedback. And it I won't mention it. It was... So you can really make someone's day from providing that feedback. Pass it on.
The only other thing I'd say about breastfeeding and analgesia is that sometimes I've found women are hesitant to take things like morphine after a C-section, for example, because they're worried about the effect on the baby. But we should be giving them clear explanations that actually it's really minimal what goes to the baby, and them being in pain is likely to significantly impact their recovery and impact their breastfeeding probably more so than the drugs will. So try and empower women to take what we can offer them.
Yeah, because you can't, well, I normally say it's not going to get rid of everything, but when you start shifting about and moving around, that's why you need to take the regular paracetamol, ibuprofen, if indicated, that I'm going to give you.
Yeah.
Because once you start moving about, like, then it's way more painful. We need to get you back to your normal baseline. That's why you need to take the extra stuff. And so, two key points that you'd like them to take away from today?
Number one, try and do the follow-ups. Really try. I know it's hard. I know labour ward's busy. I know it might not be the most exciting and glamorous thing to do, but try and do them. And number two, be thorough when you're assessing headache or neurological dysfunction. Document everything.
Mm-hmm.
Hand it over in a formalised way. Document who you've handed it over to make sure that person doesn't get lost to follow up when you're not on call the next day, for example.
Fantastic. And 2 points from me would be that Beer was the person who injected himself and his assistant and gave first documented postural punch headaches. And two, review the breastfeeding guidelines. Don't give codeine, aspirin, pethidine, diazepam or cocaine to your patients.
I mean, I feel like that's a good life lesson.
That's probably a good life lesson, really, not to take cocaine and diazepam. So glad we created a podcast to tell people about that, right?
So valuable.
Yeah, so valuable.
This is why, get all the good feedback.
This is why we get all the good feedback. So, lastly, if you've got someone that you're concerned about, escalate it quickly.
Okay? Yeah, speed is of the essence.
Speed is the essence for some of these rare things. Hello and welcome to the outro. I hope the postpartum visit discussion hasn't made you too postprandial if you were having lunch. A big thank you to my partner in crime, Rosie Grimes. She not only has provided some great insights into the postpartum visit, she has also put up with me for another episode. So thank you. I would like to flag you over again to the links in bio that we mentioned in the intro, including the BJ article on postpartum headache, co-authored by Dr. Robin Russell. We then have the neurological deficit following spinal article, and finally, the association's guide on breastfeeding. I hope this episode has made you understand why the postpartum visit is really important, and that your care doesn't just stop once they leave the anaesthetic room. You're a patient advocate, and going to see them is important not only to make sure they haven't got neurological deficit, including headache, post-procedure, but that they understand their analgesia regime, the advice that we give regarding breastfeeding, and that they can be signposted to debrief areas if they need that, as their primary concern is very likely to be the baby and they'll put their own health on the back hold. With that in mind, I would go to the postpartum visit knowing how you can arrange people to have follow-up or get them into birth reflection groups. Our next episodes will feature more on communication within the world of obstetric anaesthetics, and we're delighted to have Susanna Stanford join us, who is a prominent patient advocate who gave a keynote speech at the OAA annual scientific meeting in 2015 and sits on a lot of human factors and patient advocacy groups within the UK. It is a fascinating conversation, and her story is a practice-changing one. So I would really recommend to have a listen. We look forward to seeing you there. Bye for now.